first episode of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Exchange is a conversation about the issues that matter to people in Siouxland. On today's program, we'll talk about the possible effects of the recent budget cuts laid out by Governor Terry Branstad on community colleges with Western Iowa Tech President Terry Murrell. And we'll take a look at the history of the meatpacking business in the Midwest. That and more coming up on The Exchange. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The state of Iowa is facing a $110 million shortfall. Governor Terry Branstad told the legislature last week he would like to cut the budget for the state's 15 community colleges by more than $8 million to try and stop that money from going to the wayside. Western Iowa Community Tech College President Terry Murrell says he and other staff want to figure out what they can do to make up for what would be a $480,000 cut without impacting students. Murrell says state funding helps pay for general education classes as well as workforce development. He says if the cuts go through, it would be hard for the school to take on another workforce development project this year. Murrell says he realized before Branstad announced the cuts that the situation with the state budget might affect Western Iowa Tech.
Well, we knew cuts were coming. You never quite know what they are. At one point, I think there was some understanding that maybe all of education would be held harmless. Instead, it ended up being just K-12. So we weren't quite sure exactly what to expect. It ended up being $8.7 million from the community college budgets, which ends up for Western Iowa Tech to be $483,000. And for our budget, that's a very difficult number considering that we just have 5 months of the year left really to be able to make that up, because we really have a responsibility to try to balance our budget both to the taxpayers as well as to ourselves to make sure that we're fiscally sound.
Well, I know that community colleges are funded a little differently, say, than, you know, Regents universities. And could you explain a little bit about how that works?
Well, sure. There's really three primary ways that community colleges receive their funding. We receive money from the state. We do have a local property tax assessment, and then we have tuition. And 99% of our revenue comes in that way. We've got a little bit of revenue that will come in from sales at our bookstore and other things like that. So the initial intent from the legislature was that community colleges were going to be a third. So a third of our funding was going to come from the state, a third from property tax assessment, and a third from tuition. Where we're at today is about 30% of our revenue comes from state aid. And actually, if this $483,000 were to take, it would be below 30%. About 5% of our revenue comes from property tax assessment, and that means about 60% or more then of our revenue does come from tuition. So it's changed a lot a number of the years, and really a larger burden than of the payment does go directly to the students. The Regents Institution, and I don't know their total amount, but they really have revenue from the state and tuition are the two things that they have. And they do receive significantly more from the state than we do. In other words, we're roughly around $2,500 per student we receive from the state of Iowa. The Regents Institutions receive more than $10,000 per student. So there's a big funding difference there.
So considering what they said, how it will affect Western Iowa Tech financially, how will that affect students?
Well, you know, our budgeting, at least philosophy, has always been trying not to have students be impacted when there are budgetary issues going on. So I guess at this point, we've got some folks that are getting together to try to figure out what we can do budgetarily. This will still require legislative action. So it's not 100% sure. So we don't want to start running into a whole lot of things. And actually, the House, from my understanding, is I've got a number of folks from the House trying to hold the community colleges harmless in this. So we'll have to end up seeing what happens. But we do have a number of staff members that are getting together to try to figure out what it is that we can do to try to make up this $483,000 without impacting our students. Again, with 5 months of the year left, and the longer we wait to put that in action, the more difficult it becomes.
I was reading a story about Scott Community College out in eastern Iowa, and some of the people there were concerned about, if this goes through, the effect it would have on their workforce development efforts. Is that something that you're concerned about as well?
Yeah, you know, really the funding we receive can go into many different pots. What most people think of when they think of community colleges are the credit classes that we have, and that is certainly a big part of what we do. But another part of what we do is workforce development, and we'll work individually with businesses, and we'll also have some open enrollment classes where folks can go in there. And that is a growing part of the college. My guess is maybe 10 to 15 years, that might be a bigger part of our college than the credit classes. But we will, over the course of a year, serve about 8,000 credit students. We'll serve about 20,000 workforce development students each year. And so, yes, when we're talking about the total pot being less, we have to figure out how to spread that out, and that definitely could affect our ability to respond to companies' needs in the workforce development arena.
So what areas of the curriculum would fit into workforce development?
It's really partnering with institutions. So I think a number of people are aware of an initiative that we had with Sabre. Sabre Communications at one point was really looking at expanding their facilities, and they were worried that Sioux City did not have enough welders for them to do that. So they started looking at maybe relocating to other communities. We sat down with them and tried to figure out what we can do to help. And one of the things that we ended up doing is a very specialized training program just for Sabre, where we would train students to do the one weld that they need. It would be a very expedited training session, and we were able to train 180 welders in about a 13-month period, and 180 was the amount that they needed.
So that's very important for this area.
Absolutely. To be able to respond to the workforce needs of our area is something that is really critical, and most people don't know that that's what community colleges do. We just had actually Sabre and Jalita come to our board to talk a little bit about some of the things that we do. But we have a number of companies that will come to us from time to time when their industry changes, when their market changes, when new technology is introduced, and they need help to be able to respond to that. Because we're really, you know, we've gone from the area where a lot of our employers in Siouxland were regional employers, where they really had a regional market. Now most of them are at least at a national market, and many of our businesses are an international market. And so every competitive advantage is needed, and workforce is a huge part of that competitive advantage for the U.S.
I know a lot of students here are taking courses that will allow them to move on to a Regents institution or some other four-year institution. There's been a lot of talk lately about more and more people wanting to take online courses. Is that something you see Western Iowa Tech doing more of in the future to sort of reach, be able to serve this particular group?
Well, we with our mission, we really, there's kind of, I guess, two groupings of students that we have. One that are kind of a transfer students that are taking primarily arts and sciences type courses, and another one that is what we call a career and technical education, where they're really training for a specific workforce job. About half of our student body is in each one of those. Definitely either one is a very big part of what we do, and both, I think, are critical to be able for us to be able to serve the community in the way that we're serving those. And online actually is probably a little bit more on our transfer program, but we do have some online components to some of our career and technical. You know, the percentage of our overall classes in online has grown significantly over the last 10 years, but it's starting to level off now. There's a certain group of folks, I think, who want to study online, but a certain group of folks who want to be able to be in a classroom where they can have conversations with people. And about 30% of our enrollment is online, and about 70% is going to be face-to-face. And so that number has seemed to stabilize probably over the last year or so.
Western Iowa Tech is a little over 50 years old now. How much do you think this institution and sort of the whole institution of the community college in the United States changed since they all started to come online in the 60s and 70s?
Sure. Well, it's changed a lot. It's changed in what we do day to day, and it's also changed in perception. I know that a number of years ago, there was the belief that you went to the community college because you couldn't make it going somewhere else, or you didn't have any other options. And that's not really the case now. We're seeing many students choosing their first choice is coming to a community college, and much more acceptance, I think, in the community of community colleges and of students having the community college being their first choice. We're also seeing the articulation is significantly different today than it was even 20 years ago. There's really not the problems in transferring credits that there maybe was 20 years ago. There's very, very few issues. Most of the issues involve, so I went to community college and got a degree in auto body, and then I want to move to a four-year university and get a degree in marketing. Well, those auto body courses generally aren't going to be able to be used towards marketing. But if you took any marketing classes, they're going to transfer. So the transfer, issue that used to exist really does not exist anymore. As a matter of fact, almost all of the four-year schools are really trying to say, we want to work with you because we want your students. And 20 years ago, that was not the case. So I think even our partners are seeing what the value that we can bring are, which was not the case 20 years ago. One of the things that almost all of our partners, particularly the regents, show us data on is when our students transfer to Iowa, Iowa State, UNI, they actually are more successful than the native students, and by native students being students who started at those schools when they were freshmen. So there's a strong value in getting a good, solid education at a community college and then transferring on to a regents school. And those students that graduate show that they have everything that's needed to graduate, and they're much more likely then to go on to the four-year university and graduate.
I think anybody that has taught here as an adjunct even, it can really feel how kind of driven the students here are. There's a real commitment on their part to make it work, to get on in life. They have very specific goals, and they're very dedicated to those goals.
Yeah, particularly the non-traditional students have made a serious life change to come back to school. And absolutely, they are very dedicated in what they're doing. If I had to quit my job to go back to school or take significantly less hours, which means live on less money to come to school, I'm going to try to get the most that I can get out of that. And it really makes for a neat classroom environment when you've got the half of our students, again, are non-traditional students. Half would be considered the traditional student, the 18, 19, 20-year-old. When you've got a classroom with those mix of individuals in the classroom and the mix and sharing of ideas that occurs is really a neat thing to sit and observe, but makes, I think, for a richer classroom environment as well.
Well, it sounds like you feel cautiously optimistic about the financial situation here. That's sort of what I'm hearing.
Well, we'll continue to do what we're doing. The really cost of the $483,000, from what I see, is the opportunity cost. In other words, what would we have been able to do that now we can't do? The things that we're doing, students are going to come in, they're going to have a faculty member in their class, they're going to have a quality faculty member in their class, they're going to have lots of other students where they're going to be able to interact and do the things, they're going to be able to get the degree that they want to get, there's going to be advisors and all those other things. Western Iowa Tech will be here, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary, we'll be here for another 50 years, we're a very strong institution, but the thing that I'm afraid of is, what happens if we get another business like Sabre. One of the things that we've looked at is new programs. We're probably not going to be able to start a new program this year. And if you go too many years without starting new programs, your curriculum gets a little maybe not as current as it needs to be. So for me, no, it's going to be a very solid experience for everybody that's here. We're going to continue to do what we're doing. Those opportunity costs are what we're not going to be able to do are my biggest fear. And that'll have an impact on where the college is 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
Is there anything else you wanted to sort of add here? Do you think you said it? Or?
Well, one thing I guess I would like to share is that this is our 50th anniversary of Western Iowa Tech, and we're really trying to celebrate what we've meant to our communities over the last 50 years. A couple of things that's been shared with me, at least, is we've had over 30,000 graduates at Western Iowa Tech in the last 50 years. And if you think about it, most of the community college students stay in our community. So we know somewhere between 90 and 95% of those students are still here in Siouxland. And so 30,000 people are here in Siouxland making a difference. One of the things that I had someone talk to me about and I really agree with is it would be hard in the course of your day to go through and not come in contact with someone who's graduated or had a big impact here at Western Iowa Tech. If you're going to do anything in healthcare, if you're going to do anything that has to do with your house, your car, you know, anything out in one of our major businesses or industries, you're going to see a Western Iowa Tech graduate. And we really believe that those 30,000 graduates have had a tremendous impact on our community. And we're looking forward to see what that impact is going to be in the next 50 years.
That was Western Iowa Tech Community College President Terry Merle talking about the possible effect of a proposed $8 million budget cut to the state's 15 community colleges. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3 and KOJI Okoboji 90.7. The meatpacking industry has been a mainstay of American life for more than 100 years. In this promotional film from the 1960s, the modern packing plant is described.
Consistency of quality, convenience features, and emphasis on tenderness are paramount points followed meticulously by the packing industry. The history of meat packing is a story of steady advancement from its very beginning. Marked progress in the industry results from improvements in mechanization, advances in refrigeration, and important developments in refrigerated transportation.
Meat packing for many years was the main economic force in towns like Sioux City. In a new book, Tied to the Great Packing Machine, The Midwest and Meat Packing, Iowa native Wilson Warren takes a look back at nearly 200 years of the meatpacking industry. The Western Michigan University professor grew up in the meatpacking town of Ottumwa.
Yeah, I grew up in a meatpacking town, and it was a big part of the economy there. My parents were both school teachers, so I wasn't directly involved with it, but virtually, you know, everybody that I went to school with had family that had worked in the John Morrell plant, so it was a big part of the town. The other influence was probably when I was in high school. I read, like so many kids do when they're in high school, I read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, and that made a big impression on me. So it's kind of a combination of that, and I went to graduate school and studied labor history and got interested in labor union history, and so the meatpacking industry in Iowa obviously was at one time very heavily unionized, so those are probably the main influences.
You did a lot of in-depth research here in the book about the industry, how the industry worked, how unions worked, how people were employed and where they were employed, how much they made, all sorts of details. Now, how long did it take you to write this, and where did you get your information?
The core of the book was really research that I did for my PhD dissertation. I went to the University of Pittsburgh and was there starting in the mid-'80s, and I finished in 1992. So it was about 3 years worth of work directly. And then I used parts of it for the first book I wrote, which was just on the Ottumwa meat industry. And then the second one was really I'd say the rest of the research, plus probably probably maybe another 3 or 4 years worth of work on top of that. So
it took quite some time for you to do this.
Yes.
In the book, you talk about how there are basically four eras of the meatpacking business in the United States. Could you sort of explain those, what they are, and what went on in each of them?
Sure. So those four phases that I discussed, the first is what is referred to as the merchant wholesaling. And that's really the early 19th to the mid-19th century, around the Civil War era. That's basically the river towns along the Ohio River were really the first sort of concentrated areas where there was meat processing. I mean, just to back up just a little bit, meat, of course, has always been was made, but not in really an industrial sort of setting. And the merchant wholesaling period was really a kind of part-time industry. Meat was made in the wintertime, basically, late fall to winter, because that's when animals were taken to market. And so they would set up shop in these establishments. And some of them, like in the Cincinnati area, employed several hundred people processing meat. So it's fairly large scale. And then the rivers were used to ship meat, both upriver and downriver. Then the second phase develops really when the railroads develop. And that's why Chicago developed as kind of the premier, what was called the terminal markets, with stockyards and then the packing plants set up in the stockyard area. And there were several fairly large cities that were part of that terminal market era. And that really runs, the heyday of that is probably 1860s until really the World War One era. That's really the heyday of that one. And Sioux City is a part of that terminal market era. I was reviewing my notes. Sioux City's stockyards, they get going in 1887, and then they're pretty firmly in place with packing plants by 1895. And then the third era is what I call the direct buying era. And that's really, we're kind of in a continuation of that now. But that starts in the immediate post-World War One era, where farmers, instead of marketing through railroads, the trucking industry in the 20s and 30s and 40s becomes much more important, and farmers then are able to ship animals via truck to packing plants that became scattered more throughout the smaller cities in the Midwest. And Ottumwa is, although the railroads were used for shipping animals there too, but the trucking industry was really instrumental in places like Ottumwa that developed the meat industry. And then the final era is the kind of more advanced version of that direct buying era, where starting in the 1960s, this is where the companies like Iowa Beef Processors, IBP, and that whole modern era of the industry, it's not only plants sort of centered in the livestock areas, but the plants really are not just processing meat and then shipping it to retail centers. They're really doing the whole business of from animal to processed products and selling it much more directly to the consumer.
How important were the meatpacking plants, especially, to cities like Sioux City, when it comes to the economic health of the town?
They were absolutely vital in a place like Sioux City. My calculations were back in World War One to World War Two era, over half of the manufacturing employment in Sioux City was related to the meat industry. I believe there were three major, and there were, of course, several smaller ones, but the three major meatpacking plants in Sioux City were Swift and Armour and Cudahy. And then all the rest, and then the stockyards themselves employed people. I mean, it was a huge part of the economy, and that was... And it's still true, of course, in some of the Iowa towns, but places like Sioux City, its heyday in that sense was really, through the mid-20th century. And I just can't imagine the economies of these places growing, except, primarily through the meat industry.
Well, immigrants were, and they're still, an important part of labor at a lot of meatpacking plants in the United States. But the origins of the immigrants have changed quite a bit over the years, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. So again, in Sioux City, very interesting history. Early 20th century, you had Poles and Russians settling in what I believe was called the Bottoms neighborhood.
Yes.
You know, in and around the packing plants, the stockyards. And then African Americans became very important. And, you know, it's about, my calculations, about, I think, a quarter or so of the workforce in those, you know, those major meatpacking plants were those peoples. And then, of course, after World War II, and this is more, you know, true of the Midwest now in general and throughout Iowa, certainly, we get the surge of Latino immigrants into packing plants. And that's really a product of the, you know, especially the 1980s to the present. I mean, my hometown of Ottumwa, when I go back and visit now, it's really startling to me almost just how different the demographics of the town are, because there's so many Hispanics there, and they're drawn to the meat industry that's still there.
So you talk a lot about unions in the book, how important they were at one time. Now, the role of unions in the meatpacking industry has really changed over the years. What kind of power do the unions have now?
Well, now I think much more limited. I mean, the union movement in general, of course, is much less powerful than it once was. But again, back in the mid-20th century, not only in terms of, you know, providing benefits for workers and plants, but their political influence was very important. I mean, the immediate post-World War II era, I would argue that, in part, the Democratic Party became a part of the political landscape in Iowa because of the impact, not only of the main union in the CIO was the United Packing House Workers of America, the UPWA. That was very important, but the United Auto Workers, there are several other manufacturing-based CIO unions that are helping to advocate for the Democratic Party, and the party really becomes a substantial part of the politics in Iowa, I would say, because of the labor unions. And, of course, you know, now in the 21st century, and this is true nationwide, is the labor union movement has declined, so has the Democratic Party.
You talk in the book about women who worked in packing plants, and around here a lot of people's family members, mothers, grandmothers, worked in the plants around Sioux City. Now, at the time, it seems like those are pretty good-paying jobs for women.
They were. You know, and that's often forgotten because, you know, now we associate, you know, work just in general in a packing plant with being, you know, pretty undesirable. But especially when the union movement had a foothold in the industry in the mid-20th century, those were really the best sorts of jobs that not only men, but for women especially, could get. So they became jobs that were really, you know, highly desirable, paid well, good benefits, vacation time, all sorts of things that, of course, not just women, but men and women had not really had until the union movement.
Today, there are always a lot of complaints around Sioux City about the smell of meatpacking plants and the pollution that goes along with it. How much do you think the meatpacking plants are hurt by this kind of thing and worries about pollution?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. One of the things I just sort of mentioned in passing in the book is that when I was growing up in Ottumwa, and, you know, you, of course, depending on the wind movement that day, you know, you could really smell it, very pungent. And, you know, people would refer to, oh, that's the smell of money. And, you know, I think traditionally it didn't really bother people that much, really, the notion that, oh, it's somewhat of a nasty sort of business. I think, you know, for a variety of reasons, you know, in the late 20th century, early 21st century, we were much more concerned and probably much more knowledgeable about especially air and water impacts of an industry like the meat industry. And, you know, I think it's an important part of why people are much more cautious about just consuming meat in general. It's not just the direct intake and, possible impact on health, but just all of the environmental potential impact of, you know, making meat. So, yeah, it's absolutely a concern today in ways that just were not the case, say, 100 years ago.
There are a lot of health concerns about eating meat, a lot of environmental concerns about producing meat. Do you think these concerns are going to really impact the future of meatpacking plants?
I think so. I mean, I think we're already seeing it. The most commonly consumed meat now in the United States and many other countries is poultry. And that rise of kind of poultry consumption, it's more complicated than this, but it's partly related to all the, you know, research that had been done, and especially in the 1970s, 1980s, saying that, well, red meat is not good for you. Too much cholesterol and so on, too much fat, that it's much better to eat chicken and turkey. People have accepted that, and I think we're seeing the impact. There's, you know, a considerable shift now in the industry to poultry, and it's not completely going away, but a relative decline in production of beef and pork, and I think that will continue. Yeah.
That was Warren Wilson, author of Tied to the Great Packing Machine, The Midwest and Meatpacking. Warren is a history professor at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. Warren is also the author of Struggling with Iowa's Pride, Labor Relations, Unionism, and Politics in the Rural Midwest since 1887.
Hey, call me the meat man. You ought to see me eat now. I'm the meat man. You ought to see me eat now. I got jaws like a bat trap, teeth like a raisin, a Maytag tongue with a sensitive taste. I was born in Texas, the land of beef. I never cared much to dreams join the hell like meat. I'm the meat man.
Meat man.
Ought to see me eat, man.
Meat man.
I'm the meat man.
Meat man.
Ought to see me eat, man.
Meat man.
I've been down to Macon, Georgia. Ate the buzz off a Georgia peach.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City, 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College.
The Black Death Jet Set is a band made up of bass guitarist and vocalist Casey Schroeder, guitarist Joe Hansen, and to drummer Rocky Hoffman. A year ago, they released an album that darkly sailed into a bad relationship. Following that, they took some time off. The recent election season motivated them to regroup, to find a way to digest the world around them. The three joined me in Studio A to perform and talk. Casey Schroeder begins the conversation. Joe Hansen follows.
It's more of a socially conscious record this time. You know, our last record was a dark affair about a lot of seedy things. And I think this is more about what's going on around us. I don't know the word I want to use with everything that happened, you know, over this campaign and the Sanders thing, the Clinton thing, the Trump thing, all of it. It was just nasty, and it's kind of left everybody in a very tense state. And I think that's a lot of what this is about, is just, you know, everybody's worried of what's going to happen. And I think there's a lot of division, a lot of tension, and it's going to be a crazy place for a while. It's going to be entertaining, at least.
The tensions are high. Yeah. In our culture, and obviously then the record should hit home for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think it's, well, for us, I think it's perfect timing for, you know, just the writing creativity that we want to get out, but also the message that it's going to hopefully deliver and should come across pretty clear, you know, be welcoming to the times.
Well, is there a song that you have that speaks to these issues?
Or? Everything that we've recorded so far really touches on it. The first song that we on the record is a song called Under the Sun, and you know, it's the beginning of it, you know, it's saying that here's where we're at, obviously we have to still move forward. That's where it starts, and then the song that'll follow it is a song called Promised Land, and that's where it starts kind of getting into the fact of, like, as a society we have become so technology has become such a crutch for all of us, for a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people are attached to their cell phones, their computers. I'm not saying I'm not innocent of it, because I'm one of those people too, but it's isolating us from other individuals, while, you know, they're championing it as a way to be in touch with people. But I think it's drawing us further apart. You know, people are spending more time worried about social media and just, you know, what's going on there instead of what's going on around you, directly around you, with, you know, the people you actually can reach out and touch and you see and, you know, that you're close to. And I think we're losing that. I think a lot of people are losing the closeness of just humanity, period.
Mm-hmm. I think that the world a lot of people engage in most often is the world we find through our screens. So that does seem to be true, which is does create that paradox of feeling very connected.
Intricate piece to the flow of the record, for sure.
It's the beginning.
Everyone is dead. Nothing lasts forever, despite the lies you've read under the sun.
Needed break after having produced an album earlier last year, two albums,
EP and a full length. The three of us are extremely excited to be playing live again.
Mm-hmm. What is it about playing live that you're so charged to go back to?
It's what makes it all worth it. I mean, mm-hmm. If you're a musician, you know, that's everything. Recording time comes and goes, but I mean, you'll be able to play live forever, you know. Mm-hmm.
The great American poet Jonathan Bon Jovi that said, "I've seen a million faces and I've rocked them all."
Yes.
That's what it's about.
Wise words.
Seeing a million faces and rocking them all. Something about a steel horse, too. I don't remember all of it. It all gets lost in translation.
I think the closing of the Chesterfield is maybe something we could talk about. The Chesterfield has been a place for a long time for local bands to go and
Most
play.
Definitely.
It's been an important venue. Do you think the closing says something about our area,
in all due respect with the Chesterfield, you know, that was a great place for all of us for a lot of years. Mick was always great, you know, at least to the three of us. I have nothing but good things to say, you know. But I think everyone seeing somewhere like that's doors get closed, I think was kind of more of a realization than, you know, a shift. I think it was more of a realization of, you know, kind of on what we've been talking about tonight. You know, it's kind of the same thing, just the social unrest, downfall, whatever you want to call it. I mean,
uncertainty.
You have to go somewhere for it to stay in business. We also see a lot of stores closing in Sioux City around us, you know, with, you know, not to name drop marketing, but, you know, some department stores here in town.
I'm going to miss that one the most. I know exactly which one you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, that's real close to my house. I don't know, but it's also been going on in Sioux City for a while. You know, it's nothing that's new to anyone. You know, things come and go. I think when major staples go, you know, especially within a music scene, you know, somewhere that always was there, you know, I think it was just kind of an eye opener of the state, you know, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing for the future. I mean, we all definitely need to do something, you know, we're all going to need to pull together, you know, do what we can for each other as far as, you know, the music scene, you know, bands here in town. There's no other way, you know, nothing's going to be given to us. That's mm-hmm. for sure.
So, do you have another song?
We're going to actually play a song called, we call it Wolves. Its full title is actually called Wolves of Extinction. And it's about, you know, the powers that be that, I don't want to sit here and be like, oh, conspiracy theories, because who's to say what's real and what's not? But obviously, there's a lot of stuff that's very questionable. You know, there's a lot of shady dealings out there. So that's what Wolves is about. It's about, you know, the people that are obviously trying to keep us scared with terror levels and, you know, fear mongering and...
So this is a song for birthday parties?
Yes, most definitely. Yes. Age range, 3 to 9 years old. Uh-huh. You should definitely teach your children to sing it as they're playing Hungry Hungry Hippos.
Yes.
Which is a great birthday
game. The album's going to come with balloons.
Yes.
Yes, good.
Let's play it for
them. You want to play Wolves?
Yeah.
So I need to turn on some pedals here. Thank you, Rocky, for reminding me.
Tell them your secrets. You tell them your lies. You're already dreaming. Just open your eyes. The wolves of extinction. They know our names. They lust after fortune.
Thanks to Mark Munger for that interview. You're listening to Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3 and KOJI Okoboji 90.7. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, it's that time of year again. It's cold. Christmas is over. There's nothing to do. But that's not true. There's a festival in Cherokee that was founded for this very reason, chasing away winter blues with blues. Siouxland Public Media's Allie Carson has more.
Why are you never coming home, baby? Because I found a new love that's so true.
I paid attention more to rock and roll when I was growing up. I'm old. I'm 73.
That's Jim Adamson, a volunteer with the Cherokee Jazz and Blues Festival.
And I graduated high school in 1961, so I remember rock and roll things like, or names like Bill Haley and the Comets, the Beach Boys, the Beatles, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, you know, just working my way along and learning what is out there. And when R.J. Baker started this festival in 1992, he came up here from the Kansas City area and helped recruit musicians from Kansas City. That opened me up more than I had ever been opened up to that music before. So it was new to me even then.
For being someone so involved in the Cherokee Jazz and Blues Festival taking place on Friday and Saturday, it may come as a surprise that Adamson was a latecomer to the jazz scene. But once he heard the swing rhythm and sweet harmony, he became an active listener.
I think it was the lively music, the full range of music, because it can be mellow and soft and quiet, and it can be upbeat, like a rock and roll tune, you know, it runs the full range. It's been with us for generations.
Part of the festival focuses on inspiring the next generation of listeners.
One thing I've noticed for years, you know, this is our 17th festival. Consistently, these professional musicians are generous with others who are getting started and would like to join in on stage. They're very generous with them.
Hector Anchondo, a blues musician from Omaha, Nebraska, will be leading a jam session from 1 to 5 p.m. Saturday at the Gathering Place. Young and emerging musicians will be invited to perform on stage with the pros. The two-day festival includes performances by alternative folk singer-songwriter Damon Dotson.
You know I've let my heart go tumbling for you.
Roots and country singer-songwriter Chad Elliott.
I could walk upon that line. I could ascend to the highest high.
Modern country rock artist Shane Martin.
It's a map die, a freeway stop. It's less than a mile off the blacktop.
And Australian singer-songwriter Harper, who's known for playing roots music mixed with the haunting drone of the didgeridoo.
Life's too short for hatred, life's too short for greed. Life just isn't long enough for negativity. Happiness is easy, happiness is free.
The Cherokee Jazz and Blues Festival wraps up on Saturday with a big band dance featuring music by the Merle Lake Orchestra.
You see people that have been together as couples for years, they get out there on the dance floor, they move as one. They've been doing these dances for years. It's fun to watch them gracefully move around the dance floor. I'm pleased that my hometown has this event.
Again, that's Jim Adamson, a volunteer with the Cherokee Jazz and Blues Festival, taking place this weekend. More information about the festival can be found online at CherokeeJazzBluesFestival.com. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.
Thanks today to Terry Merle, Wilson Warren, Marsha Poole, the band, and Mark Munger, and also to Steve Smith and our engineer, Rick Turner. You've been listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. The band's name was Black Death Jet Set. Next week on The Exchange, we'll talk about what Iowa and Siouxland are doing to combat human trafficking. That and more next Wednesday at noon on The Exchange.